What's the topic?
Bob, I wanted to know, I was leafing through your Trump book, and I just wanted to get a bit more clarity on, so the global membrane on the level of the Android meme, can you shed some light on, like, how the hexadic level interfaces with the global membrane or goes beyond it?
Okay, so the space we're in, and did it come in with telephones, party lines, maybe, party lines back in the 20s, or...
I had a party line.
Right, so...
When I was growing up, we had a party line.
I would say with the internet and the two-way communication or multi-way, where are we right now? We're some electronic node, right? It's a nowhere place that the whole world could be in listening to the show, and we'd all be in the same spot, and we'd also be in their home. But we know that's not the whole story. It's discarnate. So I call this unified place that you can go. Maybe that's what Lewis wouldn't lose me by the phrase magnetic city. So we're in the monster magnet, to quote Zappa, and that's one. We're all fused in that one place. Not personality-wise, but technically we're all in one place that we can't figure out where it is in 3D terms. So when I have LaRouche's number 7, and that's the old-fashioned lucky number, so that's the old magic. And studying cosmic awareness, we're moving into a new magic because of Rai returning to the plane of essence in 67. The Evergreens added to that by saying, they told me the new lucky number is 8, Bob, not going to be 7 anymore. So they knew something was changing. So I put LaRouche. He's kind of unlucky, LaRouche. He's old-fashioned in a way, but pretty good for the chemical body representative. So he's number 7. Then McLuhan doing... logic proportionality, you know, the Thomistic thing, A is to B, C is to D, that's 2 as to 2. So you get 22, and you get Toronto, 2 run 2. I called McLuhan 22. I said we were Club 22, and we were Club 22 when we were in Toronto. We used to call
Bob, LA. It's Wyndham Lewis, come on now, catch up, it's Wyndham Lewis, catch up.
Okay, that's partly right. Remember, Lewis wrote, and McLuhan quotes it in Ecclesiate Archetype, Lewis wrote back in the last, I think it was, he believed not in oneness, but in two-ness. So, and I have Lewis is the, what McLuhan replays on the chart. So, that's partly right. You bring in Lewis as part of the 22 quadrant. So then, I make the women dominate the, or attempt to dominate the Thompson quadrant, and that's why I have Cowgirl in there as, a job, a role. And Thompson was one of the earliest guys supporting feminism on an astral, spiritual, Buddhist level. And years later, other men claimed they initiated the feminist movement or early supporters. And they're supported by Gloria Steinem. And so Thompson was pissed off that nobody recognized what he had done way back in the 70s in terms of feminism. So, because it was a new agey spiritual feminism, maybe the chemical body feminists didn't get it. Anyways, Isis is the number 18. So if you're going to put a female aspect into that, the feminine principle, Thompson is number 18. And then, I used to say Jerry Fiocca's scene in L.A. was Club 18, because there was a lot of 18s and Zappa's addresses and all that. I don't know why. Maybe the angels, if you think angels are feminine. So, that's an old cliche. So, 18 is Thompson. So then what would be Croker, who is the guy for the Android meme and the tech body? I decided 1-4. Because, when we moved to New York, I noticed 14 took over in the news. And we were, in Manhattan was 14 miles long. There's a lot of 14s in New York. So the 90s were 14. And the 80s were 22. So we're in this 14. So here's how, remember, the number doesn't mean the numerical number. It's a symbolic number. So the 1 of 14 is the global membrane. The 4 is the reaction by the chemical body and maybe the astral body going through paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, or ecstasy in response to the resonating note of the one. So most people are exaggerating and are extreme, you know, beginning with the talk shows of the 90s, Monty somebody, and these guys, people come on, working people come on and act out some crazy scenario on there. So the bizarre spectacle started to happen in the 90s. After the Android meme, which was 1960 to 1990, it's hidden ground. Now it was figure, and then it became, after the crazy talk shows, it became the Internet. So the four is metaphorically your choices in how you respond to what's happening. And you're usually forced to be extreme. Now, you're not literally a Freudian schizophrenic or paranoid, and all those psychological terms or psychoanalytic categories, they're probably too obsolete. They're too chemical body oriented. But, so actually I say people can put on schizophrenia. That's the churches of genius. You can put on paranoia and all the things. Now, when you watch a show like The Dark Journalist or some other popular show, you'll see people saying every conspiracy in the book and every attitude. They're quite nuts on the commentary during the, whatever The Dark Journalist is talking about with Joseph Farrell, say. And I had to come up with a term, the quadrophenia, the excessive hyper-individualistic communication, no attempt to match with anybody, maybe to say, oh, I agree with you, but then you would add to it. And they're always correcting each other. So that chaotic public communication is the four of one four. So you get that, Chad? So the global membrane is one half of the number, that's the one, and the four is the Android meme quadrophenia part. And you put the two together to get the era of the Android meme, which is basically the machines coming alive and running everything. They're not on the tech body level yet, but they're beginning to be some kind of consciousness there. And of course, by 99, pop culture made a movie to illustrate that awareness with The Matrix.
Mm.
And that's after 60 to 90. That's the after. That's the after. I mean, people starting to realize that they were somewhere weird for those 30 years. And Croker was correct to say the JFK assassination was a postmodern event because nobody could figure out who did what to who. Right? It was postmodern. So that's a good point. The postmodern world begins in 63, which is within the 60 to 90 framework when the Android meme was the ground.
Okay, but is the Croker quadrant, is that global membrane yet? Or is that not until
the global
we get to
membrane,
the
McLuhan started talking about the global membrane in the early 60s, and especially in his review of Burroughs in 64. So McLuhan knew that the satellite hookups were starting to create this resonant node. Fiber cables, whatever it is that satellite technology create. So basically they say in 1968, news people could now get reports via satellite, and so the satellite era began. And it was ground, from 50 Sputnik 57 to 68, but part of the pop culture of 68 was during the, Democratic Convention, everybody started chanting, the whole world's watching. That satellite, ground becoming conscious. You know what I mean? The whole world's watching. And technically, I saw the guy at Barnes & Noble who wrote the book 1968, some professor, and he mapped out how that was the year satellite technology came in and became a big factor in news coverage, changed news. So that's the beginning of the membrane being built.
Okay.
Funny, just very quickly, they're saying the whole world is watching, potentially, meaning all the audience in the world, but literally what they mean is that the little simulated world is watching, that the little extension of Earth, the idea of the satellite as an extension of the whole planet, the extended world is watching.
Well, they didn't mean that. You know, that's, they were just thinking of the content that people were using the satellite environment, and that was important, they thought, that people... They didn't know that it wouldn't matter how many people were doing it. The impersonality of the Android meme would start coming in. And that becomes obvious to people with Reagan, an actor being president. What the hell? Why are you having a simulation, you know? That was the first shock. That was the popularization of the post-human or the simulation world that Bojan, I remember writing about in the 70s.
Okay, but the whole world is watching. They're anticipating this surveillance society. So yep, then you got Reagan in the next phase with George Bush, the hidden ground behind that, the CIA.
Yeah.
Surveillance guy.
Yeah, but people thought with the whole world watching, they weren't paranoid about surveillance yet. Because they thought that the population, if they were watching it, they would do something with the knowledge of the injustice in Chicago. And then they found out it didn't do anything, and actually it helped Nixon become president, which they never expected. They thought Robert Kennedy would win, but he was dead. Then they thought McGovern, I think it was running, would win. And they were shocked that Nixon won. But many people said that the silent majority, let me say this, the silent majority, they didn't like the coverage and these stupid kids running around, so they said, we need law and order. So Nixon won. You could even say that Abbie Hoffman and those guys were paid by the CIA to have the riots, the Yippie riots, so that Nixon could get in, because they knew that effect would happen.
That's a very dark notion, but it could be, because, you know, they had this faith that coverage would solve the problem or something. The only problem is that not enough light is thrown on the police brutality or something. So if we can just throw the light on the police brutality and look, they're beating us as they always do, but this time we have cameras and the whole world is watching, then it's like, yeah, they basically just had a faith that the audience
thoroughly
repelled. But it turns out a lot of them were like, yeah, right on.
This is how you explain that is the Gutenberg bias was that people would read information and they were basically good, and if you said it correctly or something approximately true, they'd agree with it and you could form a majority. So that's matching. So back in the 60s, people thought you put the right information out there, then everybody will match with it and you'll get somewhere. That was wrong. They didn't know that Gutenberg effect was gone. And the humanist dream of the 60s didn't work. And we're into people making up their own spaces and identities. They weren't matching, they were making. And making schizoid, paranoid, hysterical, or ecstatic, or panic responses. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, thanks for recommending that book, Counterculture to Cyberculture, because it's laying that process of how the psychology went through those transitions.
Yeah.
That you just described.
Yeah.
By the way, and Bob, it was Hubert Humphrey that Nixon won.
Oh, you're right. You're right. It was Humphrey.
And then the 1972 election was George McGovern.
McGovern, right. And people thought Humphrey would win. He had sort of an okay image, in a way. And it was a Democratic decade, so people didn't think the Republicans did. As the world seemed to be progressing and changing, the Republicans were becoming an image of more and more obsolescence. But actually, the Republican was the right party in terms of its libertarian and celebrating the individual, which was the digital world, was ultimately going to hoik up the autonomous individual, or what they say, the atomized individual. And the mass tribalism of the first half of the 20th century, peaking in the 60s, would not hold through the 70s, 80s, so he started to bring in actors representing the tribal meme, like Reagan. But people were becoming more and more hyper-me decade in the 70s, and then just individualistic. And, you know, Madonna, in terms of feminism, represented the new individualistic feminism by, she didn't follow Gloria Steinem's principles. She wore bizarre clothes, and everybody else wore their own clothing. The uniformity of the fashion world was shattered by Madonna. So she represents the digital autonomy, and she's been that figure all along. You know, I'll do it my way, and fuck you. She's a female Frank Sinatra.
Just back to Nixon for a second. So Kennedy beat Nixon because of the TV environment favoring Kennedy, but you're saying that Nixon got elected later because of the satellite environment?
Yep, I would say that, yeah. Because satellite makes every culture a satellite to each other. That's what McClune said. every nation, every culture is a satellite to everybody else, so they're all equal, so they're all paranoid. And that's why he said, we're retrieving the tribal condition, which is 24/7 paranoia. That's the way acoustic space societies work.
Okay.
So that was the content. Meanwhile, tactile interplay, represented by Zappa and music, was taking over on the culture level. And more people started understanding interplay. So you would see corporate guys would come to the people in seminars and that, and say, okay, we want to listen to you. You tell us your views, and we're interested. We'll respond, and we'll have a dialogue. The whole dialogue, which was tactility, that had never happened in politics before. As a corporate mandate, you know what I mean? As sort of a preference, every thought, okay, that's fair. These corporate guys, General Motors, they're fair. They're going to let us talk. But that was an effect of the media, and because you're living within the effect, you're not looking at the causes, you're duped by it. So people got into, EST and workshops and cults, all kinds of tactile interplay all over the place in different forms. And the movies got more tactile. They didn't.
Would that include interdisciplinary studies as well?
Yeah, definitely. That's McLuhanism applied by the POB guys. They were interdisciplinary with subjects. And Barry Nevert says a generalist, in McLuhan terms, it's not a guy who knows everything about different topics from book world, in other words, encyclopedias. A McLuhan generalist knows how to operate in all different media environments. Doesn't have a bias.
Right.
That's so different.
More tetrad manager kind of approach.
Right. Yeah, and so that what Don Thiel called the synesthesia and co-anesthesia. Co-anesthesia, I don't know where he got the word from, but co-anesthesia is more and more the viewer of the art form is in the driver's seat. So the first expression of that was the auteur theory in cinema, that Andrew Saracen's critics of film in the 60s, as film became art form, everybody emphasized the director. Now, it's not us becoming director, the consumer, but the director became, within the making of the movie history, start celebrating directors. That was auteur theory, A-U-T-E-U-R. But once you got to cable TV, where you could choose different programming, and you didn't have to follow the three networks, that gives you autonomy, puts you in the driver's seat, so the co-anesthesia factor is increasing. And then the internet really puts you into the co-anesthesia factor. So people know about synesthesia, which is a sensory tactility, a mixture of the media and the senses. That's understood. But nobody knows about the co-anesthesia, which puts you in the driver's seat till eventually you are a fucking god in your media projection. And you interact with all the other gods. And that has to be a tactile interplay.
Did you create that term, co-anesthesia?
No, Don Thiel. I learned it reading Don Thiel, and I never found out where he got it from.
Okay.
But he's really a good media ecology. He's the first to talk about that. That there was, yes, synesthesia, but the co-anesthesia was more and more the audience and the individual will be put in the driver's seat. And so the POB people call that atomization. Now, fragmentation, we're not on the same page anymore. The left is a bunch of idiots. They're all arguing among themselves. And the right just says, yeah, we're for individual freedom. The right has a better ideology for the effect of the digital era. And so I guess that's what the neocons were. They were former lefties in the tribal 50s and 60s. They in the 70s and 80s, went for the individual bullshit and created the neoconservative ideology.
So it gives the illusion of detachment from a centralized authority.
Right. And so McLuhan's point is, or Thiel's point is, look, co-anesthesia is going to take over. That's due to technology. Be aware of why you're in the driver's seat. You're not really in the driver's seat. You're still subject and the victim of the technology, which makes you think you're in the driver's seat.
And ultimately, everybody is a victim of whatever the ground of the energy environment is. And until Coldplay comes around, it's all still centralized.
is still friction based, based on money and paying your rent.
So every technology above that level, everything above the ground, would be limited to the parameters of the energy, to the nature of the energy source.
Right, so the...
It would all be friction.
Right, so the internet, the tactility of the internet, multi-broadcasting, what do they call it? Two-way, multi-way broadcasting, that was a soft, beginning to have software frictionless experience, where people could be on the internet, and they don't have to wait for CBC or something to broadcast stuff to you. You had content 24/7 that you could drink Coke and smoke up or shoot up and fucking float around in imagery 24/7, right? And that's a kind of, I say that software friction anticipate, no, frictionless, anticipating hardware frictionless, which is Coldplay.
The porno version. It's the porno version.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Android meme was the was that synesthesia and co-anesthesia, the frictionless reality was what the, that's a characteristic of the Android meme. So the Android meme was technology being the artist, the Seurat, S-E-U-R-A-T, the guy who painted TV in the 1880s. The Android meme in the 60s was painting synesthesia and co-anesthesia that was coming. And the frictionlessness. Then, everybody knew we need hardware, Coldplay, and so people started fantasizing about cold, free energy, like in the 90s. And you know, Pons and Fleischmann, got that going pretty well for a lot of people. And everybody waited for it. That's what James Martinez does. He runs around, goes to these conferences. And I keep, every now and then I say, you fucking idiot. We're the ones who did it. If you fucking paid attention, we tell you how to find out, and you can tell your buddies over there, because he knows
all the time. What the fuck is co-anesthesia? What the fuck is that? co-anesthesia is bullshit. What the fuck is that? Goddamn word. We're looking for some verb. We need some verb here.
When you get out of the washroom, what are you doing in the washroom? Hines in the washroom. Co-anesthesia is what you promote, Ion. Everybody becoming their own autonomous power source and a god. That's co-anesthesia.
But they don't. That's what's wrong with it. They don't. We say that, but they don't. Now, you're using that as an example of how they're supposed to achieve nirvana. So, break it up, David.
Yeah, they don't because they don't have the concept. They don't listen to me. They don't have it defined about how they are duped by the situation, but technically they are free and have power.
Okay, true that.
Yeah. Technically they are, but they don't have the right ideas about it. Concepts. So, why are we saying this, Jed?
Well, I originally asked for you to lay out the interplay between the global membrane and the new hexatic.
Right.
So we're almost up to the hexatic in your...
So we didn't finish. So we got it's the global membrane interacting with analog media. That's the Android meme. And the ground of it is endless tactile flow, or immobility even, just having everything at your fingertips. So what's the next number? The Dobbs quadrant, which is the fifth level. So it's beyond the four, but it sort of interplays... I'm inside each one of those quadrants, so I'm part of them. My number is 8. And you put that on its side, it's infinity, a Mobius strip. And so the tactile interplay, increasing, extending itself, is symbolized by the 8 on its side. So the hexadic is the 8 on its side. That's the mystery body.
Or the double O, the 8 on its side, looks 00, yep, like in that clip from the Albert Brooks movie we heard last week, where the woman is obsessed with, she's going all in on 22 over and over again.
Yeah.
And on the last losing one, she loses because it comes up 00 instead. She wins once, but then by being too focused on the near quadrant of 22, she misses that it then goes to 00.
Right. So yeah, the double zero is important. That's like the void of tactility squared by the android me or the hexadic. And it's hexadic because it includes the previous four quadrants plus. Because Bob Marshall, in his famous first session with Ion, I think his first question was, this was back in April 2009 after Chad had a session, he asked Ion, and Bob Marshall was the first to hear about Ion. He was the first guy I talked to and said, hey, we, the evergreens are back, is what I was telling him. I think that's even on the recording. So he asked Ion, is there tactility in non-physical? And Ion said, no. So that's interesting. The tactile interplay, which is like mind here, our minds are tactility. What we think of mind is the thing that organizes your data, your sensory, and makes sense of things. That's not non-physical. Non-physical is something else, right? It's a weird experience that when you die, you go into non-physical and you're basically having a pretty good time.
Right.
So the hexadic is bringing that. So I've had at this point the other day, you have a bit of non-physical in you, you float. So why Jesus could float is that he had seraphim in him, and he had some developed non-physical, so he could walk in water. And that's why right. The eye cell, the non-physical eye cell, is in the eye block, and so it floats. So there's a lot of people who are, I'll just say this, there's a lot of people who are developed on the non-physical level that they could walk in water if they thought of it, if someone told them. But they don't think they can, so they don't do it, but they might surprise themselves. They've got enough non-physical in them to float. So what were you going to say?
Bob, I was just going to say that it sounds like the hexadic technologies are, like, outside of the auspices of the 6 degrees of separation. So... They
yeah, say
can't
that again.
How
was the first part? I missed the first part. You said something?
Oh,
technology?
It sounds like the hexadic level of technologies is outside of the realm of the 6 degrees of separation, right?
Right.
So
and that's
nobody
what,
can
that's
explain
why,
how they work.
And they can't see the eye cell in the RNA drop when they use their modern microscopes. They can't see the non-physical.
Right.
So they don't believe Carol has anything. But what she does do, she gets the university lab to study the remake and how it's absorbed. And, you know, they prove with science's understanding that this is a different weirdness that this magnesium is doing. It's being absorbed. That's the results of the first study. And, you know, the scientist, Taylor Wallace, I think his name was, he was blown away by it, you know.
So that's why, you know, that's one reason why Ion would come on and say, like, everybody's fucked. Because they're still doing the 6 degrees of separation. They're now in a Coldplay landscape where things aren't going to make any sense to them. And they're going to be lost.
You see, Ion... They have different definitions of what they are, but the recent one is antiphonal. That is an interplay of music, right? Some one group echoes
acoustic.
The other group.
Yeah.
And that's almost tactile, acoustic tactile interplay. So Ion is somehow resonant echoing on the music, acoustic space, spherical level, not visual space. It's a response to what's going on. So it's not a tech body. Not an angel, it's not an alien, not a god, or it's not God, it might be a god, but it's very interesting when you take the word seriously and figure out what it's saying about itself.
Well, vibration.
Yeah. Vibration and frequency and all that stuff, those cliches can be applied to Ion, but you'll say the word antiphonal and nobody knows what that means.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta look it up. And it's a very interesting definition. So the,
whole language changes to accommodate the new hexadic level. Nothing, the old constructs won't work And right. The problem is people will, maybe this is why Ion comes on and yells, because it's like, you guys haven't picked up the new language, more verbs.
Yeah, and we've spent, they're saying we spent a lot of free time, we didn't charge you, where we gave you what you should put your attention on. And you're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Is Ion's beat. Now Ion says to me, now JW says to me, when he downloads our office hours, because he gets everything later, after it's over, it all comes into his mind, and he says, you say the best stuff, Bob, the other guys are idiots. And so I think Ion monitors this, because Ion learns from what I'm saying. So he's here to hear what I'm saying.
That makes sense. I mean, Ion's been doing that since they came forth.
Yeah. So that's why they're here, Brian.
Well, we're waiting on to see what Mary Louise has to say about it first.
I think it's great that Mary Louise is a Bob supporter. You know, that's what Ian says. You know, she died. She died 4 days apart from Eric McLuhan. And I knew Mary, and she was a nice person. I liked talking to her. And she apparently, when she got dead and could see the whole scenario, she said, "The fuck, man? Me and Arthur were working for Bob." And Arthur's still alive. He doesn't know, but I know. So she's been around a lot, Ian says.
Yeah, they all become Bob fans on their deathbed.
Yeah. Some become Bob fans a little too late.
Yeah.
Or whether not on their deathbed. Or after the big moment, they become Bob fans.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe it's after. But yeah, you probably go through a lot of weirdness when you're dying. So you don't know where that knowing begins.
That's where they encounter Bardo Bob.
Yeah.
Bob the Bardo.
Bob the Bardo bro.
The badass Bardo boy. The badass Bardo boy.
Yeah. Did you say Bardo broker, Chad?
Yeah.
I like that. That's nice.
So the, so I think that the history of technology is very nice. You have the extension of our senses, and then you have the completion of the extension of the planet, and then you have the extension of the machines, and then, that's the Android meme, then you have the extension of non-physical. It's fucking logical. That's right. What we're here doing today.
And the number for the hexatic is 42. If I recall correctly, wasn't it?
Is that right? Well, that's from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The answer to the universe is 42. Yeah, I think Ryan has played with that.
Interesting. Yeah, it lays out very nice. Thank you, Bob. Thanks for explaining that.
Yeah, I think it's simple stuff that you can stick in your mind and know how to say it, and you can be interesting in any conversation if you know that stuff. And also, you don't have to fucking think. You just say the Bob knowledge, you know? And it's enough for someone to, if they're smart, they'll stop and they'll make them have a second look at what's going on, because you're presenting something reasonably perceptual, not conceptual, not theoretical. It's just describing what is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Greg is very stubborn. He stupidly resists all this stuff. And Scott. And Clinton. And most anybody else I met.
Now,
I think it's because you're so balanced, Bob, that you're able to be aware of all these different quadrants and stages without getting tilted into any of them.
Yeah, I consider myself tactility. Because I don't take in visual stuff. I was just thinking, I was looking in my bedroom last night, said, I never look at the fucking rug that's on the wall that Kelm put up there. I could not tell you what color it is. I don't take things in visually. And actually, ALP said that to me 10 years ago. He kind of noticed, Bob, you don't have very strong visual definition. And I said, I agree. I'm a tactile person. I respond to the vibes between people. And so I don't care how I look. I don't care how you look. I don't care how you sound. I don't care how I sound, though I try to be grammatically correct. But basically, I'm a tactile person. So maybe I'm an extension of tactility, and that's what you're calling balance. Because the tactile non-organ is the balancer. It's the thing that takes your sensory data and makes coherent consciousness.
That was a mouthful. The tactile interplay is the balancer.
Yeah, it's not a sense. It's the interplay of the senses. So then you put...
Unless you said the tactile non-sense. That's what you said, right?
It's not a sense.
Yeah.
If you play with tactility, it becomes nonsense for synesthesia. But the Evergreen said that when you take LSD, it scrambles your signaling in your brain. I would say it scrambles your tactility organ, which is not an organ. So for most people, it's the mind. They talk about, my mind can't take it. They know there's something that's not embedded with the senses that sort of organizes things. So the updated word brought in by McLuhan is tactility is the word for mind, not brain. Brain processes the sensory data, but there's a empty spot there that is orchestrating it, and that's why they don't know what consciousness is. It's because it's tactile, it's not a sense. So it organizes your sensory interplay. And so the internet, it does an extension of tactility, to the max. It interplays it organizes everything for you. All the previous analog media are content in the digital space. So that's an extension of tactility. So you'll see I have tactility squared in the Coker quadrant on the far right column. That's the only one that squares tactility.
So we have an idea of which senses get extended for the first five stages up to the pentad. What about the senses in the hexadic? Is there just no senses?
I was going to actually bring it up. So you look at the right-hand column of the chart, and you've got the sensory ratios, a figure ground, what LaRouche emphasizes, and what is his ground that he doesn't deal with. So you've got LaRouche's sensory ratios, you've got McLuhan's, and in McLuhan's you bring in tactile. You don't have tactility in LaRouche or Thompson, only in McLuhan. And then Coker squares McLuhan, so he's tactility squared. So then what is in the Dobbs quadrant? Not sensory ratios, but the two charts, the tiny note chart and the Dobbs formula chart. And the tiny note chart comes out of the Dobbs formula chart. So there are two charts that are the ratios. So Dobbs on a whole other level. I'm not dealing with the senses. I'm dealing with whatever the charts are pointing to.
That's like Logos.
Yeah. Two kinds of logos is in my ratios. And I'm anticipating the hexadic. The hexadic is represented, if you look at the bottom of the formula chart, it's a flat line. There's no content, no ground. It's just a flat line to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hexadic. That's non-physical. But we don't have a means to express it in sensory terms.
Interesting.
So that's
a flat line. It's like the flat line on the heart monitor. The sine wave has gone flat.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what non-physical was. It was a place for people to die to because they couldn't stand being immortal.
Die to instead of something to die for once.
Right. You would die into the guff, and you always judge yourself, Ian said. And you could judge yourself before he died or after, but you had to resolve your judgment of yourself, and then you got into the guff.
Yeah, Ion makes a big deal about the judgments in the Book of Revelation, which is, as you presented with Ion, a very media ecological exegesis of the Book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Die two and die four. Die four is die two squared.
Right.
Yep.
So that's how I organize my thinking when organization is requested. I don't live that way, you know what I mean? I live tactile. I'm always just picking up on whatever's going on. And I've always picked up on what was happening in Hidden Ground, starting with McLuhan and Zappa and Cosmic Awareness and everything. I went where the ground was sort of edgy, you know. I always had a good nose for the leading edge.
This is an important edge of the world.
Yeah. What'd you say, Brian?
It's an important point, I feel, that you're, that it's kind of, it's reactive, something, that you're saying, if I am pressed to, you know, gun to my head, organize your thoughts, this is how I would organize them, but I don't mean to imply that I necessarily, that it's necessary to organize them or something, even. That, I don't know.
Right.
Just the idea of trying to be it's hard to clarify that, but just the idea of being reactive that way rather than imposing it. Like, well, if you insist,
I have a mind. I prefer not having a mind, but if you insist I have a fucking mind, okay, here's my mind map.
Right.
And I offer it to their minds, which they require. They require to have a mind. I tend to, the way I look back at the way I've lived, I lived really, like, not mind. And awareness said that. They said I had a extraordinary ability to relate high something symbols in a transpersonative mode. And transpersonative meant a kind of ESP. I'll look up the actual words. It's the most precise fucking thing that.
So an essential thing that's implied by that is that you're not strategizing it. That you're doing it by accident, doing it without thinking. And it's, of course, very J.R. Bob Dobbs-ish as well, the idea that, you know, how did and how does J.R. Bob Dobbs, you know, conquer the world and rule the world? And it's like, well, he couldn't tell you. He wouldn't be able to explain it because he's not, you know, the reason is because the best laid plans of mice and men, you know, gang got to Glay and Bob doesn't have any fucking plans.
That's right.
Or something like that, you know? The mindlessness keeps him out of his own way.
Yeah. And that's what the subgenius couldn't take. I'm so blatantly mindless that it pissed him off. So here it is. Okay, so that's 1969. I'm just looking at my timeline. The September 25th, October 8th. I asked Dave Worster, who was in France, what is my purpose and direction? And they said, this awareness indicates this within the previous message. I don't know what the previous message was. So I don't have a copy of that. And it says that your action, because this was said, I think, maybe at the beginning of the session, or not the exact beginning. So something was said before, they said something, then I said, okay, what's my purpose and direction? And they said that your action in relation to the symbolic language, and I've always been very involved with symbolism. That's the way I like to think. That your action in relation to the symbolic language is that which is extraordinary. This also will aid in relating higher abstractions, which is all I do. I talk in abstract generalities. Aid in relating higher abstractions within the psyche in a manner which creates the circumstances by which you may speak through more than one symbol simultaneously in a series of well-chosen words. That's exactly what I did on CKLM. Then it says, this at a level of transpersonative interaction. And transpersonative was the awareness word for intuition, ESP in that. So I've had a kind of ESP, which turned out to be xenarchony, where I was living ahead of myself all the time. But look at that. I took McLuhan's basic words and applied them symbolically and said them precisely, so a series of well-chosen words, that I repeated all the time.
Right, and then the slowly building waves of the xenochrony created situations that allowed people to have an aid to understanding the higher abstractions by seeing a kind of an analogical suggestion of it in the situation of you facing your own coincidental echoes.
Yeah, which they say I do it in a manner which creates the circumstances by which you may speak. I created, you know, the ability to get on CKLN and everywhere else I showed up. I didn't put much effort into doing it. Who was it? I think it was Bob Marshall told me about CKLN. I didn't know about it. And I wanted to get Bob Marshall on there to do Mae Brussel tapes. So I called up the station. And John Jordan, I think his name was, he was the station manager. And he came up to my house a couple of days later. Now, I had just, well, I won't say this part. So all of a sudden we're talking, and a little later, he suddenly jumps over to my stereo and turns it on. And he sees, oh, 88.1. Oh, I see you're listening to CKLN. That was the test, the sneaky guy, right? He fucking turned on my stereo, and there was 88.1, which I just put there day before just because I was listening to it for the first time. I didn't put it there for him to see. I left it there. But, you know, I was just looking into the station, and they came up the next day, and he tested me. Oh, so they thought I was a listener. So he opened up about playing Mae Brussel.
Yeah, nice.
So that was totally accidental. So I always had slack synchronicity working for me. I mean, when McLuhan died, there's a major one. Fucking, I didn't know it. I didn't know what Barry Nevitt thought of me. I didn't know what Mark Stewart thought of me. I knew Mark liked me. But they recommended to Corinne that I fucking help her do the archive. That was a shocker, for fuck's sake. When she called me up and said, hey, they recommend you. So there again, totally slack. I didn't ask for it. I didn't even think it would happen to me. And it was really good to look at that stuff at that point.
No doubt.
Yeah, yeah. Put me way ahead of everybody else in terms of understanding McLuhan. And they gave me a couple of nice artifacts and a couple of nice articles, so it really worked well.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the stash of McLuhan notes and archives that other people haven't seen and the tapes other people haven't listened to, you know, the hidden McLuhan, the trove of hidden McLuhan stuff. Yeah, that's arguably more valuable than the fragments of advanced alien technology that they found crashed at Roswell.
Right. The shocking thing was, okay, what am I supposed to do? There's all the letters over there. You're not allowed to look through the letters. So they thought it was something special. They didn't want me, and they didn't know who I was, really, and whether to trust me. So they said, we got here about 60 boxes. Go through the boxes and put it in order. And so I opened the boxes. Oh, fucking newspaper clippings. Fucking, you know, the chaos. He was just throwing shit on the boxes. Or maybe when they gathered up his papers, they put them in the boxes. I don't know. But it was all a mess. But I was the only one who knew McLuhan enough to say, oh, this essay, I recognize that. That was written in the 40s. So I put that in a 40s box, you know? So I knew how to organize the chaos of the documents. So that was, I was the only guy probably, because I'd been reading McLuhan for 4 years and finding stuff in the libraries in Toronto. Nobody was doing that. So I was the one. So reality knew I was the one. So when I get to box 22, I find the file folder on me in it. You know, I've told the story many times. So I go home and I see, oh, I live at 22 Kenwood. So I started to think about the number 22. So that means I turned it as a symbol and related to higher abstraction. You know, whatever my mind was abstracting about, which was a lot of the time trying to figure out what McLuhan's abstractions meant. And Coker said that. He said when he was a kid out of high school, he worked at the mine up there in way north of Sudbury, you know. He worked at some factory, and the previous guy that he replaced had died by falling into it. It was very dangerous. But he said, I was reading that summer, The Medium is the Massage, and trying to figure out what McLuhan meant. And it's sort of interesting. You look back, our thinking was so immature, we didn't know what it meant. It's so fucking obvious what it meant, you know, later. But we couldn't think it. We had to think about it. So that was one of the higher abstractions I was always thinking about. And so then I told Ian Arlett about the 22, 6 months later, he comes back with a whole notebook, which he always carried around with him because he was a poet and taking notes. He says, here, Bob, I can't take it. You deal with it. And he didn't say what he meant. And I looked at it, and I saw all these newspaper articles and other things with 22 in it. And I said, what's this? He said, well, you see the 22? Yeah. He says, well, you told me that. Well, I started seeing 22 everywhere, so I collected it. And now I have so much data, it's so obvious there's a 22 thing going on, that I thought, you should fucking deal with it. I don't want to think about it. So he wasn't the kind of mind that related a symbol to higher abstractions. I was. I took the number 22, made a symbol out of it, and related all kinds of psychic whatever I was thinking to that. And that's exactly what the awareness said, which is a pretty good statement.
It's the structure of an analogy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was always looking at the symbols. Now, that's the first thing I did with Dave Worster. I met him on September 25th out in Seattle, and it was in around noon hour. He'd come to the hotel, pick us up. So we're sitting there and starting to talk. So I eventually pull out this little chart I had in my pocket. I had a little chart, and I laid out the five levels or something. I was sort of taking what he was saying in his transcriptions. I was reading that and trying to put the ideas together. And so I showed it to him, and he said, well, what you're missing is, and he points beyond the little card to space, to the room, is you're missing that. So I thought that was my first lesson from him, that I was too visually oriented. I wasn't including the stuff not on the chart in the chart. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that was a pretty interesting point he made. And I learned that right away the first day, first few hours with him. So I encouraged that because I walked in, I took him seriously. I said, he started talking about whatever was on his mind. And I said, well, what about this? Blah, blah, blah. And then I have a chart here. Look at this. And then he corrected it. So I was good at taking advantage of meeting people worth talking to. I didn't come in and tell them my fucking theories. Well, I sort of was. Maybe I was presenting my theory from my ego, but I got his correction. Other people come in and tell you what their theories are, and they want you to agree with them. So have your stuff validate them. Well, that's not learning.
It's true.
No, it's good to probe, give little nuggets of what you know just to get them talking.
Yeah, not to promote yourself. I never had an ego of trying to promote myself. So that's tactile. I knew I was in interplay with reality, so I participated. And the problem with Zappa and McLuhan and Coker or Thompson, not so much Coker, any of these people, that they were all removed. It was hard to get them into conversation. Worster was the easiest because he was an interesting non-ego guy, but it was hard to get an opportunity to interact with Zappa by yourself. You know, I had lots of opportunities, but often didn't work. It was rare to get to be with McLuhan. I used to phone McLuhan up. That's how I would do it. I'd call him up, and he'd be in his bedroom, and he'd answer the phone. And he would talk in that context. It was hard at the center. All these other people are around them. But if you were persistent and lucky, and so I had this psychic lady that Garrett told me to go to in 72, and the main thing she told me, I remember, she said, you will have access to papers that you would never believe you'd have access to. And that's literally what happened in so many ways. Beginning with the McLuhan thing, I got access to papers that I never thought I'd have access to. I didn't even think about trying to do it.
Wow.
And she predicted that. And so, who would believe you would have access to non-physical and the oracle? Ion is a completion of access to what you would never believe you had access to.
Yeah, that describes Ion's archives.
Yeah. And I had access to Zappa after a while, access to McLuhan, everybody. So it worked. But I genuinely, I would say I had grace. I had slack. I had the right attitude for things to happen around me. And that's what this message says. I created the circumstances. And I wasn't even aware I was doing it. Meeting Garrett was a big deal. This cosmic guy in stupid Dartmouth, you know? That was pretty amazing. And then the professors at Dell, Whittier was a really interesting guy. And he let me sit in his class for a few years. And then I sat at Friedenberg's class too. Edgar C. Friedenberg, who McLuhan quotes in Gutenberg Gauzy, his book, The Vanishing Adolescent. So that's how you become educated. You know, you sort of say, there must be something interesting out there. This fucking neighborhood is dull. Everybody's asleep. Fuck this. I'm hitchhiking. I'm getting the hell out of here. And you go and you bump into people. But you bump into people with a kind of a believing you're going to find something significant.
Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah, I feel, knowing you, that you have done that. You just went along and looked into what you're interested in. You didn't even go to university, did you?
No, I made a very deliberate decision to just, you know, follow my nose that way instead.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was going to be worth it to sign up for the responsibilities in order that the level of increased, like, quality and something of my education wasn't going to be worth the time and money, basically, and that I would be,
yeah.
I wanted to be, that it would be more valuable to just be available to follow my nose.
Yeah, and get by in some cheap way of making a living, but that's not your focus. You're just paying the rent and then be out there looking around, at which I learned about you very early. You'd go to used bookstores and you'd find these different books and you'd mention them to me. And I was interested in whatever you found, that you would find stuff I didn't know about. So I understood that you were similar to me pretty quickly. Now, Nigel seemed that way, but he fucked up, you know. He started rebelling or something. So he veered off course there. And Greg is kind of like that. Greg just sort of looks around. What's that beeping?
Just my phone having a sketchy relationship to its power cord.
So Chad did a Bob. He's a kid. He has a balls to write me, email me, whatever it was, and say, "Hey, Mr. Dobbs, I'm interested in what you're doing. Can we talk?" That's what I did.
Yeah. And I dropped out of university as soon as I found Bob's tapes. That was the end.
Right. Well, that was good, because he said, well, this is more valuable. I was always surprised, or at first, when I started hanging out at university, to how fucking lazy everybody was and how there was really no interest in knowledge. They were just there to socialize.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
I remember I was actually, I was kind of fond of some of the things I was studying, like, let's say, psychology. And I would talk to some of my classmates and say, like, oh, what do you think of what we learned? And they're like, I'm just learning it to pass. I don't fucking care.
Yeah. Yeah. They had a ridiculous shutdown attitude.
And then I'd say, do you know what philosophy means? Right? Because it means love of knowledge. So I was like, why are you fucking taking this if you don't love knowledge?
Yep. So I would say Brian and Greg and Clinton, Clinton's like that, right? He kept looking into things, mainly on the chip party, and explored a lot. He was curious. So that's what Fuck You University is. It's the real people who did the right kind of slack learning.
Yeah, it's Fuck University U.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would say I was lucky to meet a woman who was like that, too. you know, because Carol has done that all her life. She's gone and met everybody and just, you know, nicely went in and introduced and started listening to them. So she ended up knowing more than anybody about everything in medicine.
Yeah, you can't go through the system. You can't go through the system obediently and become anything significant.
Right. And you can't have a continuous relationship if you want one unless they're equally explorers. You know, you can't have a partner who doesn't explore. It's not going to go far.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, somebody whose core value is security.
Yeah. What was interesting about Carolyn, she had no awareness of things I was interested in. But she always came along. If I went somewhere, she came along. You know, she met all kinds of strange people she never would have met if she didn't know me, you know. And then it was all purposeful. It was all, she was meant to do that, to meet Jodun Sloan. And she always was the top person in that environment, so he gave the formula to her for the D-cell. Which then led to the I-cell.
Yeah.
Now look at that. Joe gave us a formula, and then when I showed up, and we realized eventually that I could do stuff, the Carol said, well, we want to make the D-cell. How do you make the D-cell? And then I said, well, you start off with a 400-pound block. And we go, I go, what that fucking top? I said, God, think it's a little one-square-inch cube. 400 pounds. Come on, asshole ion. What are you fucking doing? But Carolyn pursued it, and we eventually saw that the ion could make a better D-cell. He would describe what Joe was doing in the kitchen and how it had air pollution in it, and it was a hit and miss thing. So that's pretty amazing. And you look at the archives. Ion knows when to bring up Jodun Sloan in the sequence of evolution of our lives, you know? He occasionally mentioned. Oh, did you hear in the private session that Jodun Sloan was an alien?
Yeah.
and that's what Jerry Fialka always thought. Jerry took a picture of him when we met him in 88. I took Jerry over. And he was looking at the picture later and said, the fucking guy looks like an alien. I didn't think that, but he thought. And he was right. He's a fucking alien. And Carolyn, when she found out the other day that she was an alien, she said, I knew that. He said, I fucking always thought he was an alien. And he was a bit odd. And very independent, stubborn, independent guy, who studied all the borderline sciences and stuff.
Is his photo in your...